Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, a community credit union with 21 branches and a full suite of digital services. WSECU supports 9 regional farmers markets across Washington State and invites listeners to enjoy the bounty of summer at their local market. More information at WSECU.org.
Begin it where warm waters halt and take it in the canyon down. Not far, but too far to walk. Put in below the home of Brown.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer. You're listening to Sound Effect from KNKX. And what you're hearing right now is part of a poem called Thrill of the Chase by Forrest Fenn.
From there, it's no place for the meek. The end is ever drawing nigh. There'll be no paddle up your creek, just heavy loads and water high.
But these words are more than just a poem. They're a treasure map. See, Fenn is kind of a larger-than-life guy. He's a Vietnam vet turned fancy art dealer, and when he was diagnosed with cancer a few years back, he decided to put some of his valuable collection in a chest, hide it somewhere in the western United States, and then publish this poem to tempt treasure seekers.
If you've been wise and found the blaze, look quickly down, your quest to cease, but tarry scant with marvel gaze, just take the chest and go in peace.
Hundreds, maybe thousands of people have gone looking, trekking deep into the mountains and deserts of the western U.S. So far, none has found it.
So why is it that I must go and leave my trove for all to seek? The answer I already know. I've done it tired, and now I'm weak. So hear me all and listen good. Your effort will be worth the cold. If you are brave and in the wood, I give you title to the gold.
Today on Sound Effect, our theme is the long and winding road. Some of our favorite tales of the roundabout paths that we find ourselves on, seeking treasure or beauty or home. So back to the treasure hunt now with Dale Neitzel, who is an actual professional treasure hunter.
We'd rather be called search and salvage experts. When people say treasure hunter, they think of pirates. Although I have to admit, sometimes it's fun to wear a patch over my eye and swagger around a little bit.
Neitzel's from Bellingham. His background is in shipwreck salvage, but these days his main quarry is Fenn's treasure. He's gone out looking more than 60 times, and he runs a blog about the quest.
I spend most of the winter in my free time looking at his poem and trying to determine what it means. And then when the spring comes, I'm roaring to go. I head out to where I think I'm going to start looking for the treasure, and I begin looking. I begin following the 9 clues to see if I'm in the right place, if I'm going to end up at a treasure chest. You have to figure out what Forrest is talking about before you can even begin. For instance, he says, begin it where warm waters halt. What does that mean? Where does warm waters halt? And what first attracted me to this was the puzzle.
So can you tell us one story of one of the adventures you've had out searching for the treasure?
Forrest spent all of his summers, from the time he was a child up until he left for the military, at Yellowstone National Park. So I kind of believe that Yellowstone is the special place to him. And last year, I was starting where warm waters halt, and I was following this and following that, and I had ended up walking alongside the Madison River. And out of the corner of my eye, I saw what I thought was the chest. It looked to me like it had a latch on one side. It looked bronze, and it was just sitting there in the water. I grabbed my camera, I took a couple shots of it, and then I leaped into the water to get this thing. And of course, as soon as I touched it, I decided that it was not the bronze chest.
Ah.
It was, in fact, a concrete pier. But it sure did fool me, and I'll tell you, my heart was going.
How big is the universe of searchers and seekers and people who have been kind of beguiled by this story?
We certainly don't know exactly. We can only take guesses. My blog, I'm getting about 1,200 hits an hour. And Forrest He believes that last summer there were some 35,000 people out looking for the chest.
Wow. So there's enough people out there. Do you ever run into another searcher when you're out searching?
All the time. I ran into a fellow one day in Montana. I was in a cafe, and at the booth across from me, there was a fellow sitting there, and he had Forrest's book out in front of him. And I thought, well, this guy's a searcher, you know. I should strike up a conversation with this guy. And it turned out this guy is a preacher from Kansas, and his congregation sent him out to look for the chest to raise money for the church. I thought that was pretty interesting.
What is the community of searchers like? Like, what is the dynamic? Because on some level, you guys are all sort of competing with each other, but you only have each other who can relate to this obsession that you've got.
On the blog, it plays out with a lot of sharing, which is interesting. People often share their solutions with one another, and they do that to try and get folks to critique. And a lot of times, and this is the part of the blog that I like, there's a lot of support there for folks. There's a lot of, well, you know, I tried that once before, and here's the problem I had. This past winter, in January, we had a fellow who didn't turn up after going out and looking. And Forrest tells us not to look in the winter, but some people can't resist. And unfortunately, Randy and his dog Leo went out into the Rio Grande, and Randy didn't come back. The searchers themselves from New Mexico decided they needed to look more. So they put together a team of searchers by foot. They rented helicopters. Folks actually donated drones and drone time to go out there and search.
Well, I'm sorry about that. I mean, this must be dangerous business. And I guess more broadly, even for those for whom it's not dangerous, there's at the very least the danger of wasting your time and your resources. For 99.99% of the people who are searching, you're going to come up empty. Why still do it?
It's fun. You don't have to find it to enjoy the search. You know, we've heard stories about parents who have bonded with their kids. They spend a couple weeks thinking about the poem. You know, they do it around the dinner table in the evening. The family agrees on a solution, and then they spend their summer vacation checking it out and having fun.
What do you think of the chances that you will find the treasure?
Zero.
Really?
Or 100. Every time I set out, I think I'm going to find it. But I have to tell you, the very first time I went out for this treasure chest, that was the time I thought I had it. I had convinced myself that I knew exactly where it was. Everything fit. It's a 24 solid hours of driving to get out to where I thought the treasure was. And that whole 24 hours, I was imagining how I was going to spend a million or $2. I was planning on a new van, and I needless to say, I got out there and I didn't find it, but I was never, ever disappointed.
Well, Dale Neitzel is a documentary filmmaker based in Bellingham. He also does search and salvage, and he runs a website dedicated to the search for the hidden treasure of Forrest Fenn. Thank you so much, Dale, for sharing a little bit of your adventure with us.
Thank you very much.
This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today our theme is The Long and Winding Road. When you're a kid, especially an adolescent, everything feels like life or death. But for Anastasia Selby, growing up in the Seattle suburbs, it was more than just preteen melodrama. When she was 2, her mother left behind California, and her father, and the Church of Scientology, and brought Anastasia to the Northwest. But here, they had a turbulent home life, and later on there was abuse and hard drugs. And Anastasia would find her escape in books, and specifically in the books of children's author Judy Blume.
I think it was probably second or third grade when I first encountered her books, and they really resonated with me. Specifically, there's a book called Tiger Eyes, where the protagonist loses her father.
What do you remember in that book, Tiger Eyes, that connected with you?
the protagonist, Davy, she loses her dad and has to move, so it's just this traumatic thing. And throughout the course of the book, she discovers all these things about herself and is able to become independent and work through her problems. And that was so helpful to me because I very much wanted to have a father and didn't. And because I moved so much, I really had a hard time making and keeping friends my age. So I think that was the biggest thing about her books, was just that I felt so alone in my life and like nobody really saw me. And reading her books, I felt like I knew the characters and they were my friends. And it just really helped me to feel less isolated.
So far, your story could be a lot of people's stories. Mm-hmm. A challenging childhood, you know, a kind of disorganized household, parents who aren't perfect, and solace in these novels. Then things start to kind of veer off from the path that I think a lot of adolescents take. What happened when you were sort of coming into, you know, the age 11, 12, 13?
I hated school. I would not go to school. I was in sixth grade, and that was the struggle my mom and I had, was her trying to get me to go to school and me not, and her having to work full time and not being able to deal with stuff. And she was also becoming physically abusive. So we had Child Protective Services come to our house. And when I was maybe 12 and a half, I just ran away and left my house and went to downtown Seattle and went to a homeless shelter. Actually, that's a point where I ran into my dad, and he came and picked me up and took me back home. I begged him to let me live with him, and he was living in a motel at the time, so of course that wasn't possible. And my mom was actually on a business trip. After I had run away, she had left on a business trip because she had to work. So that's why she couldn't really be contacted.
I'm sorry. You were her 12 fine. Her 12-year-old girl had run away, and then she left town?
Yeah. Yep. It's hard for me to not make excuses for that for her, because I know that she had her own issues. And then when I turned 13, my mom got married to my stepdad, and it became an incredibly abusive environment, really, really awful. And so at that point, I just continued running away.
Were you still reading Judy Blume novels when you were getting into your teenage years like that?
No. You know, I read a lot when I was younger. I did drugs, hard drugs, at a very young age when I was 14, when the first time I did methamphetamines, and got very into hallucinogens, and, you know, I did heroin for the first time when I was 16, and so my reading was not there, but I do know that it was a force in keeping me alive. The books that I read, I think that I'm alive today because of some of the books I read, Judy Blume included.
How did her books and the part of you that kind of took its identity from them figure into your decision to just take off finally when you were in high school?
I think that, first of all, her books made me believe that the world was inherently good. And they made me believe that young women could be independent and were smart enough to take care of themselves. And I felt in my life that I was in danger with my parents, and I needed to get myself out of that situation, and I felt that I had the resources to do that. In the middle of high school, we moved to Olympia, Washington, and I ended up just dropping out of school, and I hitchhiked to California. So I was just like, I'm out of here. My plan was just to go down to San Francisco, and when I got down into Oregon, I immediately ran into these two young men who were around my same age, and they're like, oh, well, we actually live on this farm in Humboldt County, and I lived on the farm for 3 months.
After the farm, can you give us a little bit of a thumbnail of what the chapters that came after that were?
My mom had written me several letters begging me to come home, and she apologized for a bunch of stuff and just said it was going to be better, and she and my stepdad drive down and got me. And I tried to go to high school again, and I couldn't, but luckily for me, there was an alternative high school starting in Olympia. It's still there. It's called Avanti High School, and it was just an incredible place, and I still had my problems, and my parents were still the same people, but there were teachers there who really cared deeply about the students, and there weren't very many students. So probably my graduating class, I think, was like 25. that's the only reason I graduated high school.
How to ask this without sounding like a dad? All right. You say you kind of gained confidence that you could take care of yourself, and that those Judy Blume novels mm-hmm. kind of gave you the idea that a girl could handle herself in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Part of me is like, wow, that is amazing. What an accomplishment. And part of me is like, no, can't take care of herself in the world like that. And I'm glad that you were lucky and that you made it mm-hmm. back, but you could have been unlucky.
Yeah, I totally agree. I honestly think, though, when I look at the two paths, I was doing a lot of drugs when I was living in Olympia, a lot of very bad drugs, and I was very self-destructive when I was living with my parents because they didn't treat me like a human, really. And I felt like they wanted to hurt me. And when I was traveling and at the farm, I wasn't doing hard drugs. And I was, you know, much healthier, as absurd as it sounds. So it's kind of like, you know, yes, I would never encourage anyone as a teenager to go hitchhiking. That's stupid. It's a stupid decision. But at the same time, I can see how it was the only decision I had, kind of.
And it sounds like it was a rite of passage. It was, you kind of walked through the fire a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever come back to Judy Blume as an adult?
Yeah. When I was 29, I was actually working as a firefighter for the Park Service in Alaska. And my mom, it's a very long story, but my mom took her own life. My world was just completely obliterated. And I finished out the fire season in Alaska, and I moved down to Seattle where my mom was living, had been living, and had to take care of so much stuff. And I had severe post-traumatic stress disorder. I was dealing with my mom's death, but I was also so much trauma from my childhood came up. I was actually disassociating from my body. And I bought like five or six of Judy Blume's books, specifically Dini and Tiger Eyes and the ones about people just feeling alienated, and I reread them and was incredibly surprised at how relevant they were for my life and how much they comforted me and reminded me of my childhood and made me feel close to parts of myself that were kind of closed off to me emotionally at the time.
Has anything changed about the way that you think about your mother or your father now that you have some perspective on it?
I have incredibly conflicted feelings about my mother. I've spent my lifetime making up excuses about her behavior. Some of them are very valid excuses. And I've also been through therapy and come to terms with who she was to me, which was not good at all in a lot of ways. So I think it's 5 years since she's died, and I think that sometimes I find myself sentimentalizing our relationship and thinking about all the good times, which is great. And I run into people who are just like, remember the good things. And I'm like, but I also want to be honest with myself about who she was and allow myself to be angry about that sometimes. And as far as my dad goes, he died a year and a half ago of leukemia, and our relationship was basically non-existent. He was a very angry person. And that's something that it just is. That's it. I think what I've learned from their deaths is that you can think in circles about things and try to figure things out, but there are just some things that are indecipherable, and they don't have you can't tie them up and finish them off. They're just open, and that's just how it is.
Anastasia Selby ran away from home as a teenager, and she was inspired in part by young adult author Judy Blume. And she says the move probably saved her life. Now she lives in Syracuse, New York, where she's working on a graduate degree in creative writing. Anastasia, thank you so much for being on Sound Effect.
Thank you so much for having me.
Gabriel Spitzer, you're listening to Sound Effect, and today our theme is the long and winding road, stories of journeys. And for some of us, when the sun sets and the world slows down a bit, that's when our journey begins. This is what happens for photographer Tim Durkin. He lives in Seattle's Capitol Hill neighborhood.
The streets start really showing their personality after dark. The commuters have gone home. All the yoga stores have closed. The PCC and the Whole Foods, everybody's got their freaking quinoa. Everybody's at home with their little behind their closed doors.
Tim originally started going on night walks to escape his small studio apartment. And one night a while back, he took a walk with Sound Effects' Jennifer Wing.
This is connecting with the neighborhood. You know, this is fun to get out and see what's going on in my neighborhood. Why did the shots ring out at Pike and Broadway? Who was down here? Who saw what happened? What cop was on duty? It's like an ongoing Shakespearean play, I'm telling you. It's a lively neighborhood, and I want to get the most out of it.
On Capitol Hill, especially along Broadway, everyone knows him. Tim is known for his stunning photos of supermoons and the Space Needle, but most of the pictures he takes are of the men, women, and kids, really, some as young as 14, who live on the streets. On these walks, Tim checks in on the addicts, the mentally ill, people most of us avoid, especially when it's dark outside.
You good? Oh, is that Daniel? Oh, hey, Daniel. I'm sorry, brother, I didn't recognize you, man. How's things? Okay.
Beneath his scraggly beard, Daniel is a slim young man who's addicted to heroin. We meet him on the sidewalk at Republican and Broadway, just outside a QFC. Tim says this is the spot where you can buy a cheap bag of heroin from the dealers who travel on bikes.
If we were to stand out here without a microphone and a camera, we could score a bag of heroin in about 10 minutes for less than 10 bucks, which is unfortunate, but it is the reality out here, and it is one of the problems that the city is battling for sure.
It's one of those nights when the stars are out, but the clear skies come at a cost. It's terribly cold and flat out dangerous to be outside if you don't have enough layers. A new face pokes out from a pile of blankets inside the bus shelter.
Yeah, my name's Tim, man.
My name's Jesse. Nice to meet you.
Good to meet you, Jesse. Yeah. All right,
my dog, Dexter.
Oh, hey, Dexter. Yeah. Good to see you down there.
I don't see him.
He's keeping you warm, man.
Dexter, a small mutt snuggled next to Jesse, is wearing his own little doggy jacket. Tim hands out hand warmers, slices of hot pizza, and then he pulls out his camera that was tucked inside his coat.
Hey, can I grab a picture of you with the dog,
sure,
man?
Yeah.
Oh, sweet, brother. You from Seattle, Jess?
No, I'm from Georgia.
How long you been in town?
I've been here 6 years. I took care of my stepmom, and she had cancer.
Oh, good man, good man.
And she passed away, and I just came on some hard times. And
you gonna do any kind of a shelter at all coming winter?
I really can't because I have post-traumatic stress really bad.
Okay.
And I went to prison for 5 years because I killed my father.
Yeah.
Because he beat my mom.
Yep.
And I snapped when I was 18.
Okay.
And so I have a lot of mental issues.
You don't like hanging out with a bunch of other guys sitting on a floor.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, I have never been to a concert in my life. I can't be around big crowds.
All right.
So I just hang to myself and do the best I can.
That's good. You know your limitations. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You ever been to one of the tent cities or Nickelville?
Yeah, I have, but it's too crowded.
It's pretty crowded. Yeah. Ballard, mm-hmm. Inner Bay.
Yeah,
it's a pleasure to meet you, man.
God bless you, man.
All right, brother. Peace and love. Daniel, it's good to see you, man. Catch you later.
Yep.
There it is, the big, scary homeless people sitting at a bus stop. Eating leftover donuts, but sitting in a trash can for, 2 days. A lot of the folks that stay out here are, they're shelter resistant for a couple different reasons. One of them is that in the tent cities that are run by ShareWheel and Low Income Housing Institute, they don't allow drugs and alcohol, period. So the city's got a proposal to have 3 new shelters, one of them being a low barrier, which I think is a great idea. It would help guys like Daniel and Jesse get out of the shelters where they don't have to worry about having 2 or 3 $100 bench warrants out for their arrest, or they don't have to be afraid of using their drug of choice, which they're going to do in the bus stop tonight, guaranteed. I see it every night.
So you've been doing this for how long?
25 years, 23 years, yeah.
And how many friends on the streets have you lost?
I've lost track. Yeah, some go away and never come back. I have known there's success stories too. There was a young lady I knew who I became quite fond for, and she worked her way up off the streets and got into Harvard and graduated, and she was a brilliant scholar inside, but she just got a bad home life and some bad luck, wound up on the streets. And the next thing you know, she's shooting up dope. And I couldn't believe it when I found out how smart she was. But through her network, including me, she pulled it together and went to college, got herself through it, which is amazing. And there's other smaller success stories too.
What do you do with all of your photographs?
I've got a couple different libraries. I think my main library is over 500,000 pictures now, and a majority of them they'll never see the light of day. And that's because some of them are horribly bad. Some of them are tragic. I don't show pictures of dead people. I come across them pretty regularly.
How often do you come across someone's body?
A couple times a year. It was a dead girl I came across down in Westlake and Denny at the bus stop, right there at Whole Foods. Blue like an Oompa Loompa. Dead, she'd been dead for a couple hours. And I was in my car and I looked over and I'm like, man. But I took a picture because it was, you know, it's like 20 feet away, and you know, and called 911, and they came and, you know, took her away. But people, you know, it's at the bus stop. You know, had somebody stopped by like you and I did at the bus stop just to say, hey, you know, in that critical 4 minute to kind of 10 minute time period, she would have been fine.
We keep walking south on Broadway. We're standing at the corner of Pike and Broadway, waiting for the light to turn. A young man smoking a cigarette on the sidewalk asks what we're up to. He says his name is Shelby. He and Tim don't know each other, but they start talking, and it turns out Shelby, who has a home now, was homeless a few years ago. Tim starts asking the questions.
When you think back to your homeless days, what are a couple things that helped clinch the deal? I don't want to be homeless.
The most specific thing that I remember, and I was just talking to my dad about this the other day, was I woke up and I was sleeping in a slide that I had wedged. There was like a gap in the slide that I was able to wedge like a piece of wood and kind of make a something so I could kind of put my feet on it so I wouldn't slide down the slide all the way. And I woke up to this little girl coming down the slide that was like 2 or 3 years old. And I came down and I was like, I'm so sorry. And the guy, her dad, was at the bottom of the slide, totally was the best guy who could have this happened to. He said, it's okay, I'm not upset, are you hungry? And his daughter shared her Teddy Grahams with me. I started crying and he gave me 50 cents to call my mom. And I called my mom and I said, I want to come home. And she said, how do we know you're serious? And I said, I'll cut off my dreadlocks. And that was like a big thing for my parents. The big thing for my parents and my rebellion is I refuse to cut my hair, and so just as a sign of like I'm ready to do something besides, you know, for someone else, not just myself. So I went to a barber and I told them my story, and they cut my hair and shampooed it, and I went home and my parents helped me get into treatment, and I did good. Now I'm beautiful. Not homeless.
Dude, bring it on in here. Bring it on here, cool. Brother. Bring it on in.
I'll take it.
Dude, that is amazing. That's an amazing story. Now, do you talk to your parents still?
Yeah.
You tell your mother you love her yet this week?
I was just on the phone with her a few minutes ago.
This is why Tim Durkin walks. Moments like the one that just happened.
There's a balance to the streets. It provides me the perspective that I need. I'm not going to forget that kid's story ever in my life. It's cataloged up here. Another story.
That story from sound effect producer Jennifer Wing. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is The Long and Winding Road. So long before tech workers flocked to the shiny new apartments of Seattle and Bellevue, the Northwest offered a different kind of workforce housing. Logging camps were ready-made towns that lumber companies built specifically for loggers and their families, and they built them deep in the woods. The last of those camps closed 30 years ago, but the people who lived there, they're still around. And while they can't ever go back to the place where they grew up, they also never fully left. 88.5's Will James has more.
It's a cool morning in the Olympic National Forest. The only sound for a few miles is a handful of people walking down a gravel path between the trees.
I'm looking at pictures all month.
One of those people is Ruth Daly. She looks out of place in the forest in a bright yellow dress, and she's holding her father's ashes in a little box. Ruth is here to scatter the ashes in the woods, but not just any woods. These woods, they used to be a town called Grisdale. People lived here, deep in the forest, cutting trees, raising children. One of those children was Ruth.
I moved here in 69, and I think we left in 78. Because Grisdale was getting ready to close down.
Before Grisdale shut down, it was like a little diorama of small-town America. A neat grid of houses all painted white with green trim, a two-room schoolhouse, and kids running around everywhere.
We didn't have a whole lot of television to watch. We just played out in the woods, in the ball fields. We had a rec hall where we can go roller skating. They had a two-lane bowling alley. It was so old that you had to run down the alley, pick up all the pins, and put it back up.
Lots of people are nostalgic about childhood, but people from Grisdale take it to another level. You hear again and again about how growing up here was the best time of their lives. But when people like Ruth go back to try to recapture the feeling of living here, it was like the place never existed. Not a plank of lumber is left. It's just trees.
So that was the rec hall back there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So all this forest has grown in 30,
oh, yeah.
40 years.
Yeah.
It's been a while.
Found another flower.
The rec hall was back there. Behind that was the old store, and it had one phone in Grisdale. You cranked it.
Like a little house of
prayer. Then you picked up the receiver, and if you touched both of them at the same time, you get shocked. You pick it up, and you get the operator immediately. There's no dial. And all of us kids would go up there, crank it, pick up the receiver. What time is it? Just to talk to somebody outside of Grisdale.
Ruth goes off to scatter her dad's ashes, and I catch up with Debbie Dobson, who's walking up ahead. She's on her own pilgrimage with her two grandkids and her mom. Debbie grew up in Grisdale. Her mom was the bus driver who took kids out of the forest into town when they got to high school. Debbie's dad was the camp administrator. They fight through the underbrush and stop at a big moss-covered tree where they scattered his ashes a few months ago.
Oh, your flower? You gonna put it there for great-grandpa? They said, why are his ashes green? And I said, he's growing. It's moss, and he's giving new life. Yep, this was a tree that we used to climb in our yard. That's why we picked the tree.
Debbie's mom, Pat, is watching her great-grandkids play around the base of the tree.
They talk about him all the time, too, so makes it nice.
Why did you choose to put his ashes in Grisdale?
Because we enjoyed living up here, and this is the only spot that we lived in, one spot, for more than, I want to say, 5 years. We lived up here for 20. We were married for 56 and a half years.
You know, most people can go back to where they grew up. They can go back to their homes, but we can't. This is all we have. It's all grown up with trees now.
Yeah.
When you guys were living here, was it this quiet or could you hear the logging?
You'd only hear logging trucks during the day, but at night it was quiet. I mean,
you could have heard a pin drop.
Yeah.
No dogs barking or anything. When somebody got hurt or somebody had gotten killed, I would come into town in the camp with a school bus, and I'd open the door for the first bunch of kids to get out of, and no dogs were barking or anything. I said to myself, there's been a bad accident. And there was one time that one guy got killed, and the superintendent, Bud Dietrich, said to Warren, come on, you're going with me. And he didn't know it till he pulled up in front of this girl's house that had two little kids, and they got out and they had to go in and tell her.
You grew up in kind of an unusual circumstance, you know. Do you think it affected your personality now?
Oh, definitely.
How so?
I think I appreciate the outdoors more. I appreciate friends, because up here we were so close. I mean, 45, 47 families. Everybody knew everybody. And like Mom said, if somebody needed help, it didn't matter if you were fighting or not. You all got along and you helped. And that's just the way I am.
A mile up the road in a picnic area, there's a whole Grizzdell reunion going on. People are here from all over the Northwest. I caught up with Ruth again. She had just scattered her dad's ashes in the woods. And I asked her what it felt like to leave Grizzdell and join the rest of the world when she was 13.
Well, I was confused for when we first moved to Shelton. It was hard for me because I had no sense of direction. Living in the woods, you'd think you'd have a sense of direction. When I got in the big school, I was lost. And the teachers didn't understand quite what Grizzdell was. I begged, please just take me back up to Grizzdell.
When do you feel like you got your bearings?
I never did in Shelton. I had such a horrible time in school. I ended up leaving and going and getting my GED. I just couldn't handle it.
Lots of people here feel like that. Chris Welch has a long career at Boeing behind him, but he still talks about the shock of leaving Grizzdell like it just happened.
I knew all my friends were here. It really hurt to move. The hustle and bustle of a big city took me a while to get used to, because and the big city to me was Sumner, Washington. That's where we moved to.
Lavina Jenkins had to move her family out of Grizzdell when her husband died in 71. Even though her husband's job was the whole reason she was living in the woods, she didn't want to leave.
I had five children, and this was the love of their life. And I have one in Texas that whenever he comes home to visit, he has to come up here and camp for a couple days.
When you're thinking back to the place where you grew up, it can be hard to tell where reality ends and nostalgia begins. In Grizzdell, that's extra hard, because nostalgia is all that's left. Here's Ruth again.
This was the happiest place that we had. Uncle Dan, I talked to him just recently. He was crying on the phone. He misses it so bad.
She says if she could buy Grizzdell and let everyone live there again, she would. There's no laugh. There's not a hint she's joking.
That story from 88.5's Will James. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. You're listening to Sound Effect, and today our theme is the long and winding road. Back in October of 2015, Sarah Brandeber thought, I sure would like to see some larch trees. Larch are the rare coniferous trees that actually change colors in the fall. They turn gold and their needles fall off. They're really gorgeous. And so she set out on a hike to Lake Ingalls near Cle Elum, where there were lots of these trees. Sarah's a pretty experienced hiker, and she brought a friend, so going solo was not part of the plan. But as Sarah tells us, plans change.
It was a 2.5-hour drive just to get to the trailhead, and then it was a 9-mile hike, so it was going to be kind of an all-day thing. And my friend Cherie said that she would be willing to do it with me. I was really pumped and just kind of raring to go once we got there. And we start up on the trail, and we're less than maybe half a mile in, and I could kind of sense behind me that Cherie was not enjoying herself. And then she stopped me and said, Sarah, I can't keep going. She said that she had done her first CrossFit session the night before and her legs were shaking. We immediately started this back and forth where she was like, I'm gonna be mad at you if you don't do this hike. I really want you to bring back pictures of the lake that we were supposed to hike to. I have my hammock, I have my book and my journal. So I told her I would only go all the way if I was making a really good pace. It was gorgeous. It was easily one of the most beautiful hikes I've ever done. And the last part of the hike, it's like a rock scramble. It's not even really a trail anymore. And made my way to the lake, and I had the lake to myself, and I was just kind of eating my sandwich. And as soon as I finished, I headed back down because I was in a hurry to get back to Cherie. And it wasn't until 45 minutes, an hour later, where I really started to realize that I had gone the totally wrong way. I remembered that the whole hike up, there had been a creek flowing down. And I could hear the creek from where I was standing. And so I went to that and I said, if nothing else, the water is all flowing in one direction, down and out, so I can follow that. So that was kind of my decision at that point. Then it hit 2, 3, 4, 5 p.m. and I'm still in thick underbrush with no sign that I'm nearing the bottom of the mountain. I asked God for a sign, and shortly after I said that prayer, I looked several yards ahead and saw something bright blue and shiny up in the bushes. And I got really excited because I thought it might be a piece of equipment or a backpack, meaning that another hiker or someone was nearby. So I sprinted up to it, and as soon as I came upon it, I realized that it was a really big, still almost fully inflated happy birthday balloon, like one you would get from the grocery store in the gift section. And I had not seen a single other piece of garbage on this entire trail. So the fact that there's this still fully inflated happy birthday balloon that floated all the way up there was really bizarre. So now I'm kind of hiking along with this balloon. It hit 6 p.m. and I realized it was going to be getting dark soon and I needed to make a choice. I was a little bit nervous about spending the night in the woods. I had a bag of almonds, an apple, a banana, and half of a water bottle left. The temperature was dropping. I knew it was going to hit the low 30s during the night. I was wearing like running tights that were lightly fleece lined, and then a tank top and a long sleeve kind of dry fit material shirt and a thin down vest. And I had also left a hammock in my backpack and kind of found a spot on the ground under this low-hanging tree and kind of wrapped my hammock around me and pulled myself into the tightest fetal position possible. And I was praying that exhaustion would take over because I knew I had 12 full hours until the sun was going to be up again. So I really just prayed to be so exhausted and sleep away most of those hours. I had my cell phone on me and it only had 30% battery left and I had zero phone service, but I did have a few songs saved on my phone and one of them is a worship song that's really calming, and so I thought, well, I'll play that on low volume, kind of put it right near my ear to drown out animal noises and, you know, the wind. My phone, by the way, was still playing this song. It didn't die. And I looked at my phone and it was 5:30 in the morning, so I had slept almost 10 hours. You know, I am completely alone. I have no idea where I am. I haven't seen another person since yesterday, early afternoon. Everyone feels lonely at some point, but this was like a very desperate feeling of isolation. I knew no one could hear me. You know, if I were crying or if I screamed. And so that was a pretty sobering thought. I'm just gonna keep doing what I'm doing and follow the creek. It's gotta lead me to the bottom at some point. I'm out of water, starting to feel dehydrated and dizzy. And at this point, I see a rescue helicopter flying overhead. And I saw the guy like kind of hanging half out of the helicopter. I was so tired that I could barely move my arms, but I did my best to like wave and get their attention. And I had been hiking with my hammock over my backpack because it was bright turquoise and yellow. So I knew they would see it if anything, but they passed right over me. And that was just crushing. I sat down for a minute on a log and my legs were like screaming. For a minute, I was just like, I don't want to keep going. I'm tired. But then I had a thought of, Sarah, people are looking for you. They don't know if you're alive or if you broke your leg and you're in a ditch somewhere. So you need to kind of suck it up and keep going. So I kept hiking and hiking, and I saw what looked like a road up ahead, but I didn't let myself get too excited again because I had several massive fallen logs had appeared to be roads. But as I got closer, I saw the outline of a trail sign and a privy, and I started sprinting. And I hit pavement, and then I saw what was either a massive cabin or a house up on my right, a black lab on the porch. And the dog was jumping up and licking me and barking, and a man opened the door, probably because he was wondering what all the commotion was about, and I just collapsed at that point. I think all I was able to choke out is, I've been lost since yesterday, my family doesn't know where I am or if I'm okay. And I was crying so hard that I'm surprised they could understand me. And the man said, well, if you've been lost since yesterday, there's probably some folks out looking for you, so I'm gonna call the sheriff. So then the sheriff came to the house, and he walked in, and he just looked like someone who could keep you safe. He was like 6'5 and built and was kind of just like super serious. He's like, do you want to see on a map what you did? And he showed me where I had turned the wrong way and ended up on the total backside of this mountain. He said, you could have been hiking 4 days. That is 8,000 acres of wilderness. Judging by what you did, you hiked between 35 and 40 miles. Then we went out to his truck, and Taylor Swift was blasting on his radio. And he was like, you can change it if you want to. And I was like, nope, this is perfect. And it just made me laugh. I mean, this huge, tough guy blasting Taylor Swift. And I think I just needed to laugh at that point. I felt the lowest of lows when I was isolated and alone and not sure that I was going to get out of there or see my family or friends again. Because I allowed myself to go there emotionally. Then when I was reunited with people, I felt the greatest joy and ecstasy I've ever felt. I think that's it.
That was Seattle resident Sarah Brandeber in a story produced by Sound Effects' Kevin Canista. That's all for now. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin and Jennifer Wing, and this week we welcome Bethany Denton to the team for a while. Special thanks to Janae Janik, Ali Ferguson, Matthew Stribe, Will James, and Arwen Nix. Be sure to check out our podcast. We are trying something out a little different with it this week. You can find it at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or wherever you get your audio, and you can send feedback to soundeffect@knkx.org. We're back next week when our theme is Bug in the System. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KNKX.